Hey, everybody. Welcome to a brand new episode of Hey Man, It's Okay. I'm Sky, your regular guy who's just here to learn along with you.
And I'm Ryan, you're a licensed psychotherapist. Scott, who do we have today?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited. We have the CEO and co-founder of Frontier Psychiatry. We have Dr. Eric Arzubi on the program with us today. Welcome to the program, Dr. Eric.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really serendipitous that we get to be here today talking to you because we have such a good team getting such good guests on here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you connected and a little bit about yourself so our listeners know who you are?
Sure. So I believe you guys found me on LinkedIn.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So again, I'm a CEO and co-founder of Frontier Psychiatry. It's an all telehealth practice that delivers psychiatric care into Montana, Alaska, Wyoming, and Idaho. Our goal is really to make high quality psychiatric care available no matter where people live, whether they live in a small town in Idaho or in a big city near an academic center. People deserve the same quality of mental health care. And that's what drives us. But yeah, I've been really working with Frontier Psychiatry for about 5.5 years. Before that, I was chair of psychiatry at Billings Clinic here in Montana. And I'd moved to Montana back in 2013. It was my first full-time job out of training. People think I'm like 35 years old. I'm not. I look this bad because I'm 56. And this is actually actually my third career, but I think it's my final career, and glad to be here taking care of the rural communities.
No, it sounds like, so you said you do all telehealth. Was this something that came out because of COVID, or is this something you were working on pre-COVID to do all telehealth?
Yeah, so Montana, when I got to Montana in 2013, there was already a pretty extensive telemedicine network. So Montana, I would tell you, is probably one of the pioneers of telemedicine. There's something called it's something called the Eastern Montana Telemedicine Network. It's been around since the early 90s. And so as soon as I got here, I was doing telemedicine already on a regular basis. And in 2019, I still had patients who were traveling 4 or 5 hours to see me for a half hour visit. And I thought, man, we got to lean into telehealth more. And so we started preparing, and then we launched like the same month that COVID hit. So it was strange kind of luck. Bad luck that COVID happened, but good luck that we were prepared to deliver care once COVID hit.
Yeah, imagine that caused things to boom quite a bit for you.
Yeah, things moved along pretty quickly because before that, people were pretty okay with telehealth, but there were still a lot of psychiatrists and other sort of mental health professionals who were kind of like, I don't know if we should do telehealth. It's not the same. Is it as effective? A lot of sort of naysayers. And I think COVID forced us to try it. And I like to think, look, it's not perfect. And the other thing is I tell people, don't compare telehealth to in-person care. Compare telehealth to nothing. Because most people in these parts of the country have nothing. And so that's what you got to compare it with, right? Of course, I'd rather be sitting on the couch talking to my therapist face-to-face, but that's not an option for so many people in the United States.
What were your previous careers?
So I finished college in 91. So my first job out of college was I was a reporter for Bloomberg. This is when Bloomberg was still pretty small. It was like a start. It was a larger startup, but it was a startup. It was only about a year into their having a news service. And so I was Bloomberg's first Latin American reporter. Did that for 2 years. And then after that, I decided to actually go into finance because I'm like, man, I'm writing about what other people are doing. I'm like, I want to actually do the doing. And so I ended up working in finance in New York City, ended up being a bond trader at Morgan Stanley in New York City. So it was quite the adventure. And then in 1999, I decided, I don't know if it was either like an early midlife crisis or I don't know what it was, but I was having fun. I was living in New York City, making good money, single, but I just felt really unfulfilled. And the only role model I kept thinking about was my pediatrician from Vermont, where I grew up. And I just thought he was great. The guy was well-respected. He did so much for the community. And I'm like, man, this is my one shot at life. And if I'm going to be remembered, I want to be remembered like that guy, like Dr. Narkowitz, not necessarily like these bond traders I was working with. I met some great people on Wall Street. When I'm thinking about, I don't know, what I want to be remembered for and the impact I want to have, I think as much, I lean much more towards my pediatrician than my buddies on Wall Street.
What did that journey look like for you going from Wall Street to helping people with their mental health? Because I'm sure you saw your fair share of mental health issues on Wall Street. And to go into maybe being one of those people to helping take care of those people must have been a pretty wild ride, I would assume.
Yeah, no, Wall Street's like unlike anything else. It's, I feel super blessed. I even had the experience to be working on a trading floor. And it was just a really cool thing. And I learned a ton about people, about how the world works. It was great. But so at first when I went back to school, so I had to go back. So the journey was, it took me 14 years from the day I left Morgan Stanley until my job in Montana as a full-time psychiatrist. And probably took me longer than it should have, but I had to first go back and do pre-med classes because I hadn't done pre-med. And about 9 months into taking pre-med classes, I discovered, I either uncovered it or discovered it, or it was somehow triggered, but I had massive anxiety. It was bad. It was bad enough where I more than once was curled up in a fetal position, wondering if it would ever stop. I had my first encounter with mental health professionals at that point. I was 30 now. I met with a psychiatrist, and just like a lot of patients, when they come to me, when I was talking to the psychiatrist, I'm like, listen, I just need to meet with you and talk to you a couple of times. I don't need medications. I'll be fine. And about a few weeks later, I was like begging him for medications. I'm like, I need help. I don't know what's going on. I feel crazy. I need help. And I had to actually put a pause on my pre-med classes and take time to heal.
It's good of you to recognize that you needed to take that break to heal.
And it was, part of it is, part of it is recognizing, yes. The other part, it was bad. It was so bad that I really stopped functioning. Like I couldn't, like I tried to power through it. I remember it was triggered by a bad grade in biology. I remember this was like September, October, 1999. And I'd been crushing. I was getting like all A's on everything. And then I had a bad biology test, and then I panicked and I thought, my God, it's over. Like I quit this really lucrative career. And now I got this bad grade in biology. I'm never going to be a doctor. What's everybody going to think? What am I doing? I'm not going to make a living. And on a spiral down to, in my mind, I was homeless and out of work. And it was bad. I remember the day I got really anxious. I was like, okay, I got to go study. And I got to double down on the studying. And I remember sitting in the library. I still remember this, sitting in, I was taking my pre-med classes at Columbia and in New York City. And I went to one of the libraries, these beautiful old kind of these oak paneled libraries. And I remember staring at the page of one of my textbooks and nothing was registering. I keep reading and rereading and rereading. And I was getting more panicky and anxious, going, oh my God, I can't focus. I can't think. I'm like, okay, maybe I just need to sleep. So that night I tried to sleep, didn't sleep. Next morning, I hadn't slept and I was anxious and things were worse and it spiraled.
And it sounds really overwhelming.
What's that? Oh yeah. Oh God. Yeah, no, it was hugely overwhelming. And so it was almost like my mind or my body was almost forcing me to take a break. Because basically it said, look, it's not working for you right now. And you can try all you want. You're just not going to be able to do it right now. So I've almost felt like forced to take a break. But again, in retrospect, obviously it was the right thing to do. And I ended up going back to the psychiatrist and started taking medications, went to therapy. And about 6 to 9 months later, I was able to resume going to pre-med classes. And but anyway, sorry, that was like the very beginning of my journey. And there's a lot more to it, but I'm sure that played a big role into ultimately deciding to become a psychiatrist.
It sounds like you're a really determined person, mm-hmm. because when something like that happens, to then go back to it when that's how it made you feel before. So good for you for coming back to this.
Thank you. It was definitely scary. And I would tell you, like, somebody asked me the other day, like, what am I most scared of? Or what am I most afraid of? And it's The thing I'm most afraid of is anxiety, I would tell you. It's like anxiety of the, it's like anxiety about the anxiety. And I know a lot of my patients have the exact same thing, where you have a ton of anxiety. Like they get scared of being scared. And it's because it's a horrible feeling.
And I feel a lot of doctors don't quite take mental health all that seriously.
Do you, is that your sense that a lot of doctors you've talked to or encountered that don't take it seriously or think or make you take a back seat? Tell me more. I was just curious.
Maybe a back seat. Yeah. That it's not the same urgency or seriousness of a physiological symptom.
Yeah. Look, even in medical school, psychiatry has stigma around it. People don't quite say it out loud all the way. Is psychiatry real? Is it being a real doctor if you go into psychiatry? And I remember when I was deciding whether to go into psychiatry or something else, right? Because you have 4 years of medical school, and that last year of medical school, you have to apply for residency and decide what specialty you want to go into. Like you, right? Because still at the fourth year of medical school, I could have decided, oh, I want to be a surgeon, or I want to be a pediatrician, or I want to, it was still wide open, but I had to decide on something. And so for a while, I actually sadly was feeling, man, psychiatrist not being a real doctor. So maybe I'll go into like neurology, or I still like the brain, but maybe it's more concrete than psychiatry. And then ultimately I decided, what am I talking about? I started thinking, like, how do I want to spend my days? Like, what kind of work do I want to be doing? And I had spent during medical school and pre-med, I'd spent literally thousands of hours tutoring middle school and high school kids in math, science, and like all kinds of learning skills and things. And I love that work. Spending time with those kids and their families basically convinced me I needed to go into child psychiatry because I love spending time with them. And I finally found something I was great at. I felt I was like a jack of all trades, master of none until I did all that tutoring. And then I'm like, oh, this is my thing. I can connect with kids and I can connect to their families. And what made me ultimately decide, you know what? I'm going to be a child psychiatrist.
From Wall Street to child psychologist.
Psychiatrist.
My bad.
You're fine. No.
Psychiatrist.
Now, again, I respect the heck out of my psychology colleagues. Sometimes I got to clarify.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. It's a good lesson for me to learn for sure. You went back to school after taking your mental health break.
Yep.
Was there a lesson you learned during that mental health break that you carry through to today in your own psychiatry?
Oh, definitely. Because those lessons continued. When I went back to school after having that episode and pretty nasty anxiety mixed with depression, I would definitely say that's probably the lowest I've been. But since then, that's been 26 years. I've had dips, pretty major ones as well. And I was always terrified of going back to that place, that dark place. So what I will tell you over the years, one of the things that's given me some comfort when anxiety starts to rear its ugly head again, is that I've always bounced back. And it'll be, you know, a lot of people kind of experience, I think a lot of people experience anxiety, know what I'm talking about, where it's, if you have that feeling and it feels like it's never going to stop and it feels like it's never going to go away and you feel like it's going to get worse. And so having had that initial kind of experience and then a bunch of other nasty episodes in between, I bounce back. And so that gives me some comfort. So when I do start to relapse and it starts to feel awful again, I feel awful, but then I'm like, okay, I've been here before. I've bounced out of this before. Chances are pretty good it'll happen again.
What are some of the skills that you use to get you out of that?
I remember to take my medication more. I take Lexapro it's just every other person, even though I'm a psychiatrist, I do the same things where start feeling better. I'm like, ah, I forget sometimes to take my Lexapro. I'm like, yeah. So there's that. And I like to have a beer in the evenings, a beer or two. And then I try to work out when I can. But what starts to happen is, I guess here's the other thing I learned, is I have a really, it's hard to describe, but I can detect really early when things are starting to happen. There's a certain feeling, like the anxiety is like knocking on the door, right? And what I do very, like all of a sudden, like I make sure, am I taking my medications? Am I working out on a regular basis? No more alcohol because it affects my sleep. And if I don't sleep well, my anxiety gets worse. And also I use a meditation app. There are a couple of them that are really good. They used to be called 10% Happier. Now it's called Happier. But those, when I'm doing those things consistently, I can get my anxiety back under control pretty quickly. Quickly. It depends, but it might be 2 weeks, it might be 6 weeks. But I'm able to kind of pull myself out of it. But it's still hard. It still feels awful. Feels awful still. Back in my mind, I still worry, is it gonna be as bad as the first time? Is it gonna last forever? Is it going to hurt my ability to be a good husband, a good dad, a good psychiatrist? Those things come up for me all the time.
It's hard to pull yourself out of that spiral once you're in it, for sure.
Yep.
100%. Is there a surefire sign that's like your number one, oh man, hey, I just need to double check myself and make sure that I'm taking care of myself?
I would say sometimes it's like a random pit in my stomach that doesn't come from anywhere, or I'll wake up early and have a hard time falling back asleep. And then I can feel my mind start to kind of worry about certain things. And so those are kind of like early tells going, something's there. So I just need to pay attention to it. And so it's very easy, like when that feeling starts, and if it starts to interrupt my sleep, like it's very easy to be like, you know what? Screw it. I'm not going to go for a run today. I'm not going to go exercise. I'm not going to go outside. I've gotten better about powering through that. And that's what a lot of people call, it's called behavioral activation, right? It basically means you don't wait until you feel better to do something. You do something hoping that it'll make you feel better, right? And so that's—
Mood follows action.
What's that?
Mood follows action.
Correct. Exactly. Okay. And so it's not always perfect. I'm not saying, oh, you do that and it always works. No, but it takes an effort and I've gotten better about it.
I really appreciate your transparency and relatability, that even somebody like you who's had a pretty storied life, all these credentials, and still can have the same mental health issues that we all do.
Hey, I got the same problems everybody else does, man. Like it's funny. I know a lot of other psychiatrists. None of us are immune to this stuff. Not everybody needs to talk about it, but we're all dealing with the same stuff, all of us. And so what I can tell you is even if psychiatrists out there or therapists, we're all dealing with the same thing. We're all dealing with the same thing. And if there's somebody who says they're not, they're probably not telling you the truth. But I think it's a bizarre kind of not always fun blessing to have that. I do think having anxiety for me has made me a better clinician in some ways. I don't know. It's strangely satisfying when I talk to a patient and they're telling me about their anxiety and I tell them, let me guess, you're feeling this and this. And they're like, oh my God, Dr. Azubi, how you know? Been there, done that. And I also tend to share that with my patients. Not like up front. It's not like when they tell me, hey, I'm anxious. I'm like, you think you got a bag? I'm more anxious. I don't say that. But I try to use it in a way that's disarming. And again, I don't want my patients to think that I'm above all that, because I'm not. I struggle with the same stuff. The difference is I've spent lots of years building up a toolbox that I can sometimes apply for myself, and then I'm trained to apply to other people. But I guess that's what makes me a little bit different, is it's my job to think about these things.
you really understand their struggle.
I did. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yes, and I hopefully that comes through when I talk to my patients.
Even with my wife, she experienced anxiety a lot and I didn't really know what it was like. And then one time I experienced really bad anxiety. She was like, oh, you're feeling this. I was like, yes. She's like, sit down, calm down. It's fine. You're just having a panic attack. And so now I can connect with her better because I understand what it's like. And now I know how to recognize the signs for them in her. Dr. Eric.
Eric's fine. Totally fine.
Okay, great. At some point, you took these skills and started sharing them on LinkedIn and something happened for you.
Yeah, so I started, probably January of last year, just posting. There's still a small part of me that enjoys writing. Probably a big part of me enjoys writing back from my journalist days in the early 90s. And social media is interesting. There's something about it that I think all of us on some level, or many of us, or most of us, want to be seen, want to be heard, right? Want people to listen to us or people to acknowledge us, right? And I think social media is an interesting way for that to happen. And so anyway, so I just started writing like random stories and posts and things. And I don't know, it was really intermittent. I didn't do it regularly. Then last year, I took a bunch of classes, like a bunch of different like little courses on LinkedIn. And none of them really stood out. I kept trying and it was hit or miss. And then early this year in January, I had another class. Because again, it's like to be on LinkedIn, like every social media platform is different. And I think every one of those algorithms is a little bit different. So it depends what you want out of it and what kind of message you want to put out into the universe and on these platforms. And so I took a class, this dude named Chris Donnelly, he's like huge on LinkedIn. And full disclosure, he's not paying me to say this, but none of it was directed at mental health people. All the people in the class were like in marketing or they were like executive coaches and they were like, yeah, they were, in, I don't know. There was no mental health professional. It was just me. But I'm like, one of the things we need to do as mental health professionals, I think as medical professionals in general, we need to get comfortable with communicating to the masses. People, like we have so many people who aren't unqualified out putting out stuff to millions of people. There need to be more. Again, I'm not saying I like to think I know what I'm talking about. People have to see and read my stuff, but there need to be more people who are informed and educated putting out high quality information. And so that's how it started. And so I started posting, and the class tells you like post every day, 7 days a week, make sure you interact with every post. And there was like a 10-week period where I was spending 2 hours a day on LinkedIn. It was rough. I was worse than any of my daughters. Like I have two 19-year-old daughters now and they're like, I was more addicted to social media than they were. And so it took me a while to figure it out, practice and refine the message. But ultimately, I think I got into a place now where it's not a big chunk of my day. It's still fun. So now I post probably every other day. And to me, more recently, I've been posting about like historical figures in psychiatry, good and bad. And it's interesting to me. So I feel like I'm learning along with the people that read my stuff. Because today I posted actually about a New York City social worker who, she was a whistleblower for the inmates at Rikers Island. The mentally ill inmates at Rikers Island were being pretty much tortured. And last year she blew the whistle on what was going on there and it led to a lot of change. And so there are a lot of people out there too who have done incredible things that don't always get the attention they deserve. So I'm using the platform more to educate about kind of some ongoing topics in psychiatry and mental health, some of the historical figures, but also to hopefully celebrate mental health champions that deserve more attention than they're getting.
I love that. What have you found really resonates the most with people?
On LinkedIn? I would say it's actually these kind of profiles of different people. I think that's really, people really like those. I think people like hearing stories about other humans. They can maybe see a little bit of themselves in that person, or they can look at them as a role model, or think, man, I can, if this, again, the thinking about the Justina, I forget if it's Justina or Justina, but the social worker, I forget how to pronounce it. It's, I think it's a Polish name. She was a kind of just another social worker on Rikers Island. Like there, I'm sure there are hundreds of social workers there, but she did something different. And she had the courage to really speak up. And so I think stories like that get people's attention because they recognize that everybody has a little bit of something in us that wants to speak up for the vulnerable, for those who can't speak up for themselves. And hopefully those stories might inspire some other people to do that.
What are the biggest stories you're seeing right now happening with men's mental health? Specifically.
Specifically for men's mental health.
I know that's a big question to just throw out there. That's a really big, broad topic.
No, it's like a couple of things go through my mind when you ask that. Number one, and this is not a men's only issue, but I think about marijuana. And the problem with marijuana is I guess everything's political now, so I guess I don't really care anymore. But marijuana, it's perceived as something safe because it's been legalized in so many places. And it's unfortunate because I've seen it, and you can read the research now, but I've seen so many young people, a lot of young men come to the emergency room, psychotic, hearing voices, seeing things.
When the schizophrenia issue.
Was it, right? Yeah. So it doesn't do anybody any good in terms of kind of your mental health. Like it makes anxiety worse, mood worse, and all that kind of stuff. But in an underdeveloped brain, right, and we know that the brain becomes fully mature at around 25 years of age. And so for people that smoke on a regular basis in the years where the brain is still developing, which is 0 to 25, you're influencing the way your brain is being wired. And people often ask, is it genes or is it environment that causes mental illness? The answer is yes. It's a combination of both. And I'm sure like I was born with vulnerability and anxiety, right? And so it's up to me to figure out what can I do for my environment to reduce the chances of that anxiety actually expressing itself, right? And people who have some vulnerability to mental health problems, and we know big chunk of the population, which is just well known. What marijuana can do is it just increases the risk of something bad happening, right? So you already have a risk, right? So you have a genetics that already says you have a risk. And all you're doing by adding kind of other things like substances, being exposed to trauma, but willingly smoking marijuana on a regular basis is another risk factor that increases your chances of bad mental health outcomes. So that's one. Again, it's not a male only issue, but one of the things that kind of is happening on a regular basis. The other thing is, and I think it's getting more attention, which is good, is, you know, male athletes who, again, there's like this culture among male athletes, men in general, but I think male athletes in particular, right, to tough it out, to be tough about it, not show any weakness. And the stress and strain of being an athlete, especially we're talking about like elite level athletes, is a tons and tons and tons of pressure. And I met somebody last year. Oh shoot, I'm gonna email you the name. But he focuses on the mental health of male athletes. He talked about, and he openly talked about this, where he played hoops in college. I think he was a great basketball player, but really struggled with mental health problems and didn't feel comfortable as a male athlete kind of talking to the people around him on his team or talk to the coach. And not that they were making things worse or doing bad things to him, but it was just like not normal or not widely accepted to come talk about it. And so the more he dug into that, the more he discovered that many more male athletes are struggling with mental health problems than you initially recognized. And it makes sense.
Is it the pressure that they're under? So many of them have so much pressure when they're in high school to make D1.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's look, again, it's always a combination of genes and environment, right? So I'm sure many of these athletes are already born with some vulnerability, like we all are. But then you start piling onto that pressure after pressure. At some point, that vulnerability or that susceptibility to have a mental health problem just gets expressed, right? And it just comes out. Think about, like, to your point, it's for some of these athletes, again, I played competitive sports, then didn't quite do D1 anything in college, but played competitive sports, but my parents didn't, it wasn't that helicopter parent, sort of sports parent that we hear about nowadays, where people are, kids in middle school level are getting pressure to then go to get into the high school team and go to varsity early and then go do travel team and then to get into the college and try to get scholarship. Right. And so what are you taught? You're taught that it's never enough. Like, you make here and up, oh, not enough. Now you got to go here, up, oh, not enough. Now you got to go here, up, oh, not enough. Now you got to, so it's never enough. And so when is it enough? Like, can you actually sit back and say, I'm okay, I've accomplished things. And also, what about accomplishing things outside of sports? You also hear about athletes, and this is not just male athletes, but athletes in general, like struggling after they retire in their 30s, right? If all they've known is a sport from when they were 6, 7, 8, and then that's all they do and all they focus on into their 30s, and they still have another whole life to live, that's tough, right? So again, I'm not a sports psychologist. I'm not necessarily an expert in these things, but since you asked me kind of about some issues around male mental health, I think that's something that maybe isn't always appreciated or talked about.
Now, what do you think was it that gave you the drive to succeed at this level?
Okay, you really want to go there. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The therapist.
No, all right. No, there's definitely an addiction to having victories, right? I got to get a great grade to then get another good grade to then have a good grade at the end of the quarter or the semester. And then what does it look like on my resume? And then building up a really good looking resume. It was always like, does it have anything to do with how I was raised? Possibly.
I was going to say, yeah. Did that come from your parents?
My parents definitely put a lot of emphasis on succeeding in school and being well-rounded, but school was a pretty big deal. My dad's an immigrant. He came from Argentina. My mom is actually a Hungarian immigrant. But my dad, he was a very high performer. He got his engineering degree in Argentina before coming to the United States, then worked at IBM his entire career, basically from 1968 until the 2000s. But he, at one point, when IBM was a big deal, he was like one of their top five executives worldwide and was basically in charge of designing and building computer chips. So I imagine there was a pressure to perform, right? So immigrant dad, firstborn male, my dad being very smart and successful. So I'm sure a big part of what I was, my kind of constant, desire to achieve, is rooted in part because of that. And it's funny, that comes out when I talk to my daughters and I talk to other people younger than me. I'm like, I have a great resume, and trust me, it does not buy you peace of mind. It does not buy you mental wellness and clarity of mind. It does not, I promise you. And I've tried to de-emphasize that sort of performance in my daughters and really asking them to please look for things that make them excited, make them passionate, that bring them joy.
Has it worked?
Yeah, I think it's better than, they're doing better than I did, I think, in terms of at least, I think, not putting too much pressure on myself. They do well in school, but it's not like the main thing. And if they have a bad grade, they don't mind. They feel comfortable telling me about it. And they're like, I know I'll study better next time, or I'll study harder next time. And I don't say anything about it. I'm like, I've never, if there are times like when they're blowing things off, then yeah, of course I'll say something. But otherwise, I'm like, just try your best. And yeah, so I think, I don't know, I didn't screw them up too badly yet.
That's the best goal you can have as a parent, right?
100%.
100%. Just don't screw them up and you're golden.
Yeah. And they really don't care that I'm a Yale-trained child psychiatrist. Neither my wife nor my daughters really care about that.
Which, I've heard that with movie stars too, where it's, oh yeah, whatever, you're just dad.
Yeah. Yeah, they think, they all think, all three of them think they understand mental health better than I do. And I'm like, all right, maybe. I don't
know. What is your guiding North Star for them?
Man, I want them to be good people that make the world around them just a little bit better. I guess in some ways, maybe I'm pushing my philosophy onto them, but that's what I hope for them. Because in the end, like, that's how I'm trying to live my life is, am I adding value to my community or to whatever community I'm serving? And so when I, with them, I probably do a better job with them than myself of also remembering to find joy and really doing what you can to find purpose and peace of mind at the same time. I still find myself pushing myself maybe harder than I should to do this frontier psychiatry thing that we're doing, trying to take care of as many patients as we can. But I've gotten much better at pausing and giving myself some grace and some credit for having hopefully helped a lot of people.
I really appreciate your philosophy on that very much. And thanks for sharing. I was also just saying that I can't believe that we are almost out of time for our episode today. It's gone by so fast. I couldn't even believe that this is where we are. But if you had some parting words for our listeners, what's the number one thing that you think people need to hear right now? And also tell our listeners where they can find you and follow you.
Sure. Thanks. So first of all, again, thank you for your time and having me on as a guest. And remember, I told you finding things to talk about wouldn't be a problem. But yeah, so on LinkedIn is a place people can find me and follow me. It's Eric Arzubi. My handle on LinkedIn is, I think it's Dr. Zoobs, Drzoobs.
I love that.
Thanks. Yeah. When I was growing up, people, everybody called me Zoobs. So I just put a doctor in front of it. So it was Dr. Zoobs, Drzoobs. And our website is frontier.care. So that's Frontier Psychiatry's website. And that's, people kind of just learn more about what we do on delivering care to some of these rural states that are really struggling. But a couple of things I'd want to add. And that is, first of all, people often talk about the fact that we're in a mental health crisis. And I'm starting to push back on that. I'm saying, you know what? We're not a mental health crisis. We're now trying to survive a chronically broken system. Like, it's not a crisis anymore. A crisis is something where there's a spike in a problem and people scramble to try to fix it and the crisis is over. Like, we got chronic problems. We've got chronic dysfunction. So let's stop calling it a crisis. This is just a chronic problem. The Surgeon General in 1999 issued a report saying, oh, we got a mental health crisis. And then the last Surgeon General under Biden, he issued, I think, two reports expressing that we're having a mental health crisis again. And God bless both of those Surgeon Generals, but I'm like, it's been 25 years. It's not a crisis anymore. I guess what I'm hoping for is that people have more of a sense of urgency to actually do something. The other thing is, there's not going to be a white knight coming to fix all this. And there's not going to be a miracle drug or medication that's going to fix all this. We already know how to do a lot to make people's lives better. We know it. We know how to treat depression. We know how to treat anxiety. We know how to treat schizophrenia. Is any of this perfect? No. But not even the basic stuff is making it to all the people who need it. So for example, we know that CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, helps with anxiety and depression. Does everybody have access to CBT? Nope. 60% of all SSRIs are prescribed by primary care docs. They try really hard, but they're not always prescribed appropriately, or the patients don't always have the right diagnosis, right? So instead of trying to reinvent the wheel and trying to find new, better, greater drugs and medications, let's pause and make sure that we deliver what works to the people who need it. That's what we need to be studying. We don't need to be studying like new, super new, brand new, shiny treatments. Like, we need to be getting the treatments that work out to the people who need it. So it sounds like I'm angry. Okay. Yes. But it's also...
There's a lot to be angry about with it, though.
Yes. And I think, and I take responsibility as a psychiatrist that I've failed. I and my colleagues are failing to do this work in a more effective way. But I think I also want to give people hope that there are solutions out there that actually work. We just need to do a better job getting it out to the people who need it.
I hope that's a mission we can accomplish.
Agreed.
Because the healthcare system, yeah, if we could get more people access to proper mental health care, we would have so many less problems. And right now, people are just so greedy and we just can't get the hope and access to everybody. So I appreciate people like you who are on a mission to make that more possible for more people.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And like I said, just like normal guy, like anybody else, just trying to make a difference. And so I appreciate you guys highlighting some of the work that we're doing.
Thank you so much for your message and all that you had to say. Very appreciated.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for doing this. And thanks for having me. It's a great, I think it's a great program and there are messages that deserve to be heard.
Thanks. That does it for Hear Us on this episode of Hey Man, It's Okay, Everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to our conversation with Dr. Eric Arzubi. Please follow us on our social media at Hey Man, It's Okay. And please comment, subscribe, email us, email me, Sky at Hey Man, It's Okay, if you have any topics you want to hear on the show. But until then, everybody, from Sky, it's okay to not be okay. And thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Dr. Zoobs.
Hey, my pleasure, you guys. Thank you so much.